Have any of you ever been teachers or no? Yes, okay. Actually, when people ask me what I do, I don't say I teach. I say I speak to myself. And maybe there are some people that listen or some people that hear. And then my students ask, well, what's the test going to be like? Well, I said, well, I'm going to ask questions. And then you're going to find it difficult to breathe, and then you're going to start to sweat profusely, and then you're going to write down all kinds of things that you don't know anything about. But I do try to teach, and it's very funny because I try to teach Torah topics, and for some reason we treat Torah topics very, very differently than we treat other topics, which means virtually all of us who've gone to school, at some point in our lives, we were abused by other teachers, maybe actually some of you, and we were made to write book reports. Right. I hope you know that most students who write book reports never read the book. Yes, they Google. They'll know. Today, no, that's right. Today, they read before Google, but there were always ways. There were always ways of dealing with it. I did once have a student who had to give in a paper, and he gave in something. You mentioned hundreds of articles. He try to hand in one of my articles to me. The truth is, I loved it. But I don't know what he was thinking. We're going to be finishing the book of Bereshit today. And we normally don't, not today, I mean this week, and we normally don't think of Bereshit as a book. We think of it's a Sefer Kodesh. It's not a book. It's part of the Chumash, part of the Torah. So how can you look at it like a book? But let's think of the opposite for a second. Should we really look at it in terms, let's just say, for example, of Parshiot? So Parshiot is probably a really good idea. Even though some of us know that the Parshiot are man-made. Parshiot not only are man-made, there wasn't even a consensus among the Jews, if this is the right way to man make it. There were those, we follow the Babylonian rite, there were those who lived what they call the Palestinian rite, but I guess you can't say that today. It was the custom of the Jews in the land of Israel, and they would finish the Torah every 3 years or so, the triennial cycle. So therefore, they didn't have the same parshiot that we use today. We certainly can't divide it up in terms of the chapters, right? You all know who created the chapters, correct? Which one? Which Christians? The Archbishop of Canterbury was the one who made the ones that we have. There were two different attempts to divide it into chapters, and we follow our minhag is like the Archbishop of Canterbury, and obviously we can't just sit and study and divide things up in that way. But the book as a whole, Bereshit as a whole, if you open up a Sefer Torah, there's a very clear demarcation. There's not a clear demarcation between chapters, certainly not. There's not a clear demarcation between Parshiot even. Any poor bar mitzvah kid who had to read Parshiot Vayechi this week is not going to find it because there's no separation between the word before and Vayechi. I know, it was my bar mitzvah Parsha, and there's, you can't find it. And it says right afterwards, Vayihi, which looks like is the beginning of a paragraph, but it's not the same thing. But at the end of the book, there's a clear demarcation, the end of Bereshit, beginning of Shemot. End of Shemot, beginning of Yikra, and Bamidbar, beginning of Devarim. So is it really fair to look at it as a book? And the answer is, of course it's fair. I mean, Sefer Bereshit is a whole book. What its name is not clear at all. Chazal are not necessarily in agreement what its name should be. One thing the Chazal never call it is Sefer Bereshit, as far as I know. They call it Sefer HaYashar. Some refer to it as Sefer HaYetzirah. But it's not called Bereshit. So let's try to look at it as a book. Not as, because again, what do? We start and we look at Adam and Chava, creation, and then next thing we know there's a flood, and we look at Noah and so on, we look at the tower, and then we have Avraham, a couple of stories there, and then we have Akedah, and then we move on, and Sarah's dead, and then next thing we know we have Yitzchak looking for a wife or sending someone else, which is actually could solve the Shidduch crisis. You send someone to go on a date for you, and right? And as I said, we just look at it in little pieces, which in our little pieces are very often just the exact same thing as our parshiot are. But what about looking at larger themes? Are there, in fact, larger themes? Now, so, some of the terrible reviews that people wrote about my books is that I'm just kidding. They were great. People actually think I wrote them all because, they accuse me of finding larger themes and keep coming back to the same things again and again. And then everything goes back to the Garden of Eden. And I pointed out to one person who wrote such a review, I said, which hopefully will come out in one of the papers that you read very soon, and I said, well, what's the name of the book? It's called The Echoes of Eden, which means that there are echoes that then do continue all the way through all five books. I'm not going to do all five books. I want to look at a couple of things in Bereshit, short things, things that we can think about and hopefully take away something from it. The first thing, which is obvious and jumps out at us, and this more than anything else, is that we come from dysfunctional families. Right, that's something that we should know. I mean, the Avram family, the Yitzchak family, the Yaakov family, every single one of them were dysfunctional for different reasons. The dysfunctionality is just one part of it. There's a larger issue other than the dysfunctionality, and that is that if I had to really write a book review of Bereshit, I would say Bereshit is the book about brothers who don't get along. That's what the book is about. Would I necessarily say that is that's the main issue? I'd be afraid to say it, but it is certainly the subtext of the entire book, and it takes us from the very first brothers to the very last brothers and all the other brothers in between. It's a book about brothers that don't get along. So I know that if I asked you, well, tell me, what book is there about brothers who don't get along? Bereshit would not have been the first thing that you think about. Why? Because we don't think of Bereshit as being a book. We think of it as being the Torah. And the Torah, as I said, we look at differently. So if the book is about brothers who don't get along, what's the second part of it? The
brothers that separate when they don't get along.
Good, good.
We should learn.
Exactly. You can take over for me soon. One is brothers don't get along, two brothers separate, and three?
One is rejected,
four? Very rarely, but inevitably, throughout the book, it's the younger brother who's successful and not the older brother. I mentioned this, my older brother did not like this. But what can I do? I said, you can have Sefer Shemot, but this is what Sefer Bereshit is about. So again, if you pay attention to it, there's a theme that just goes throughout the entire book. Shemot, when you get to the very beginning, and Moshe and Aaron meet for the first time after many, many years, and the Torah, and the... One second. Yes? I can try. They're not paying me enough for that, but okay. That when we start Sefer Shemot, and we see that Aaron and Moshe go to meet, and the Torah attests, this is not something he puts on, that Aaron goes... And his heart is excited. He's full of emotion. He's full of love to see his brother. You don't have that at all in Sefer Bereshit. That itself should tell you, wow, this is a new book. Maybe there's a chance this can end up very differently. Maybe this book can end up with the Shekhinah coming down. Maybe this book can end up in a very different way than that book. Because Bereshit is not a happy book. It's not a happy book. It's a book about formation, again, the Yetzirah, formation. It's a book about starting something, and sometimes to start something is difficult. And all of us who would like to believe that life is easy and that we just have to try and things get accomplished, no, it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes we need to work very hard till we get accomplishments, and sometimes it takes lots of years, and sometimes we don't get to live long enough to see the full impact of what we've done. Sefer Bereshit is not a happy book. It ends with the death. It ends with Yosef in a grave, or not even a grave. Even better, not even in a grave. Simply in a coffin, waiting to be buried, which will take a long, long time till that happens. What other themes are in the book? So let's go back to our first brothers. First brothers are Cain and Hevel. By the way, they don't get along that well. And they get along so poorly, we don't even know what they said to one another when they didn't get along that well. Which means, again, if you think about it, they go out and some, there's jealousy. It's also a theme which goes all the way through. There's jealousy, but there's no articulation of the jealousy. Torah doesn't tell us. That's good. People do this at like every 7 minutes, it'll keep everybody awake. It's, okay, someone else will. What were the jobs of Cain versus Hevel? One is a farmer and one is a shepherd. Those are also themes that will go throughout the book. The tension, farmer versus shepherd. And the farmer versus the shepherd does go all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Because in the Garden of Eden, Adam initially, he's taking care of the animals. And then when he sins, God says, you're going to become a shepherd. Which you're going, you're going to become a farmer. Sorry. You're going to become a farmer now. Which means we have the rules of exile, which is to be a farmer. Again, for Adam, I'm not saying for everyone. The rules of exile for Adam is you're going to become a farmer. The rules of the Garden of Eden is that then you just sort of hang out with the animals. When we look at Cain versus Abel, what do we find? We find that Cain is a farmer, and we find that Abel is a shepherd. So it means that in a certain sense, Cain accepts the rules of exile, while Abel doesn't. Abel seems to be like trying to connect with Adam before the sin. And then we wonder why God likes one more than the other. Now, on the other hand, as we continue throughout the book, what do we find? We find which one of the forefathers were shepherds and which were farmers? Avraham and Yaakov were shepherds. Yitzchak was a farmer. Okay? Now, would I be right in pointing out that none of you ever noticed that before?
Yes.
Yes, okay. What's the significance of him being a farmer? Because to be a farmer, you need a connection to the land. You need to feel it's your land. He never left Eretz Yisrael. Exactly. He never left. So even though we find that being a farmer is a rule of exile from the Garden of Eden, it's also a rule of feeling that you are part of the land of Israel. So Avraham and Yaakov are unable to do it, while on the other hand, what do we find? We find that Yitzchak is able to do it. You notice the dreams that Yosef has? Okay, let's go to the first dream. What does he see in his dream? The sheaves. What do his brothers do for a living? They're shepherds. It's an absurd dream. The dream should have been a dream where one their flock bows down to his flock. Why is it a dream?
Sort of a prediction of
exile. By the way, Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed this out in a couple of different places. That the very dream itself showed that they're not going to, that there's a whole different economic reality than that we're used to right now. By the way, does that dream come true? Of course it does. Because what's Paro's dream about? What does Paro see in his dream? Animals and sheaves. Going back to the exact same two themes that we saw. By the way, am I beginning to convince you yet that we should look at this as a book and not just as individual episodes? Because as you start to think about it, and again, in terms of its broader sense, you start to realize, wow, these things go back and they repeat themselves and come again and again. So when Paro has his two dreams, if you're Yosef, what are you thinking? I had that dream already. Right? Yosef is saying, of course, I know about that dream. What is this dream going to be? This dream is going to be that in Egypt there's going to be enough sheaves that people are going to have to come from the land of Israel over here. How does he know that? Because his brothers are going to have to bow down to him. Which, again, you connect the dots, connect the dreams. Yosef realizes that Paro's dream is actually connected to his own dream. But again, it goes back to the same themes that I was speaking about earlier. So we go all the way through the book of Bereishit, we realize that there is constantly this tension between our shepherds versus our farmers. But to be a farmer, you need to be connected to the land. And now we think, wow, Avraham was not really connected to the land. Of course, you know why he wasn't. because Avram wanders from place to place. We never get the sense of Avram really, really settling in one place. Avram is born in one place, comes to Israel, then goes down to Egypt, then comes back to Israel. He's in the south, then he's in the center. And again, he's constantly moving around. That's not the way that you're a farmer. A farmer is connected to the land. Yaakov, who's born in one place, goes to another place, lives someplace else, and then comes back. Yaakov as well. That's almost, we would call that a nomadic life. So what do nomads do? What do Bedouin do? Shepherds. So as I said, the fact that Yitzchak is the exception is something which is very interesting. By the way, the Midrash, and this then goes into some Kabbalistic sources as well, the Midrash tells us that because Cain kills Hevel, again, what did Cain do for a living? He grew, right? And he made his offering out of flax, specifically. And Hevel, he brings animals. The Midrash tells us that's the reason. I know it's a chok, and I'm not allowed to tell you the reason for it. He says that's the reason we won't wear wool and linen, shatnez. That's why we don't wear wool and linen together, because those are the two separate realms of Cain and Hevel. And when Cain kills Hevel, he's basically saying that Hevel is unnecessary. Hevel is expendable. We don't need Hevel in the world. And at that point, God says, no, we need a Hevel in the world. And now the replacement of the loss of Hevel, the replacement of the holiness of the loss of the soul of Hevel, is going to be another mitzvah in the Torah. By the way, anybody remember in the book of Vayikra? I'm sorry if I'm talking about Vayikra. But I wrote a book on Vayikra also. It's okay. Remember in the book of Vayikra, the next pasuk, it says, love your neighbor as yourself, and the very next mitzvah, it says, don't wear shatnez. So what's the connection between one and the other? Who was the first person who didn't love his neighbor as himself? Cain. What happens afterwards? A vacuum's created. We need more holiness. What's that holiness? So now the mitzvah of shatnez comes in. So the next time you're very careful when you buy clothing, and you check, if it says 50% wool and 50% linen, that means 100% shatnez, and you check, and you're careful what you buy, on a spiritual level, you should also redouble your efforts in terms of how you treat one another and not just leave this as just something between man and God. Again, that would be this spiritual understanding of it, which, as I said, the Vilna Gaon spells out, but it's all based upon a Medrash Tanchuma. Who are the bad guys in the book? Esav and Yishmael. Okay, listen carefully. Just about every person who misbehaves sexually, am I allowed to say that word here? Okay. Don't tell my mother. A couple weeks ago, my mother wasn't feeling well. She said, I'm not going to come to your share tomorrow. So I said, then I'm going to talk about very inappropriate things. She said, tape it for me, but I won't let your father hear it. I said, all the people who act inappropriately sexually in Sefer Bereshit all come from the same family line. They all come from Cham. Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Cham, Rav Hirsch says, why is he called Cham? Because he's hot-blooded. Cham. Think a second. I'll try to do this more or less in sequence. Sarah goes down to Egypt. Second she gets to Egypt, Paro tries to get his claws on her. Where's Paro from? He's from Mitzrayim. What's Mitzrayim?
Cham.
Mitzrayim is from Cham. Come back to the land of Israel, Avimelech. Where is Avimelech from? He also comes from one of the nations which are descendants of Cham. City of Sodom. The two men come to Sodom and they want to attack the men. It comes from the family of Cham. What are we skipping? Yosef goes into Egypt. Mrs. Potiphar tries to get her hands on it. Where does she come from? Same thing. Yehuda's sons are inappropriate sexually. Who's their mother? A Canaanite. Which means you follow, again, it's a theme, all the way through from the beginning to end. Again, you may find Midrashim pointing accusative fingers at some others. By the way, notably, who does the Midrash stress was also inappropriate? It says Yishmael was inappropriate. It says Yishmael misrepresented Avram's teaching of Chesed. Avim Zadiyah of Chesed was to give of you, to love your neighbor as yourself, and the Yishmael tried to love his neighbor's wife as himself. That's what that's what the Medrash says. Why would Yishmael be inappropriate? Who's Yishmael's mother? Hagar. Where does Hagar come from? Hamitzrit. Which means you go all the way through Bereshit. Again, whenever you find sexual impropriety, it always goes back to the family of Ham. But as I said, this is something, when you look at each one of these individually, you don't notice it by itself, but when you look all the way through the Sefer, you see it coming out very, very, very clearly. When you mentioned before that the brother gets sent away, so when Sarah sees what Yishmael is like, Sarah then advocates for Yishmael to be sent away. Esav and Yaakov is interesting because Yaakov runs away and then Esav leaves afterwards. And Yaakov comes back, Esav leaves, they can't live together. And it says that the land was not big enough for the two of them, which is exactly the same language that we found earlier by Avraham and Lot. And Lot was like a son to Avraham. He says, this is like his son or this is like his brother. We're brothers, it says. Which means, again, we find this theme of brothers not getting along, going one step further back. Even Avraham doesn't really get along with his brothers, and Avraham's nephew who comes with him, they ultimately can't get along. What we find, the brothers Yitzchak and Esav can't get along. We find Yitzchak and Yishmael can't get along. We find Yaakov and Esav can't get along. And regrettably, we find, and this is the most painful one for us, we find that the sons of Yaakov can't get along. Now, let's pause there for a second. Part of the greatness in Parshat Vayechi is that when Yaakov sums it up, he refuses to say, this is going to be the real Israel and the others are pretenders and are sent away. He does not do that. Yaakov is ultimately the one who deserves the credit for keeping the family together. By the way, there's always somebody who has to be the one that they do something to keep the family together. Rachel was very much that woman, by the way. Rachel was very much that woman who was willing to sacrifice herself for her sister in order to keep things together, which I know is a bizarre relationship, but I would even say an extension of Yaakov loving Rachel is his willingness to do whatever he can now to keep the family together. That says that was the will of his wife. And that's the will of his wife. It doesn't make a difference how bad Reuven behaved. And Reuven behaved very badly. Right? Reuven behaved very badly. Which means you could easily have seen, if it was Esav or Yishmael did what Reuven did, that we would have no problem whatsoever to say, just send him away, he can't be part of the family. And yet he remains part of the family. And for Shimon and Levi to behave the way that they behaved, and still for Yaakov to discipline them, to let his feelings be known, but at the end of the day, we are one family. Assuming that Yaakov knew about the sale of Yosef, for him to look at the other ones and to say that you're still my sons after what you did is remarkable, but he still does that. Now, I want to point something out, which I'd never seen in the commentaries mentioned. I noticed it a couple of weeks ago. So if any of you write it down, you can publish it, you can beat me to it. So this is, should I say it or no?
Trust us.
I don't trust you. If you... Two brothers, apparently Shimon says to Levi, let's kill him. By the way, they never use the word brother when they say let's kill him. They refer to Yosef not as a brother. They refer to him as the dreamer of dreams. They can't even use the word brother. If you read that whole section of the sale of Yosef, the word brother, it's so stark how it's missing.
Except for Yehuda.
When Reuven says, we'll turn him to his father. Reuven focuses on the father. He already messed up once. Return him to his father. He knows his father's mad at him. He has to do something for the father. Yehuda says, what cynical statement. It says, it's my betza. What are we going to gain by killing him? He's our brother. Let's sell him. So I always felt that it was such a cynical statement. What are we going to gain from killing him? Let's sell him. I mean, if your children acted that way, would you be, oh, look, at least he's treating him like a brother. He called him a brother. There was one verse in between that I missed. Do you know what that verse is? Is that they lift up their eyes and they saw a caravan going by. Yishmaelim. Do you know what Yehuda must have felt at that second? Well, look at that. This is a sign from God. Yishmael was the brother who was sent away. Who else then shows up coming from the other way? A band of Midianites. Who's Midian? Who's Midian's father? I'm sorry for testing you now. Who's Midian's father? You know him. Avraham. It says that Avraham has more children. Right? Midian is the name of his son. It says, again, you're Yehuda right now. Yishmael's coming from one side, Midian's coming from the other side. You say, look at this, this is the will of God. God is giving me a message. By the way, very careful. You have to be very careful when you get messages from God when you hate somebody. Right? Because those messages that you get may be somewhat self-serving. He sees a message from God. What's the message from God? Treat him the same way that Yishmael was treated, and treat him the same way that Midian was treated. Send them away. It says that they were sent away to the east. Yishmael goes away as well to the east. Send them away. So Yehuda says, this is God's will. Look at this, a sign from God. And takes Yehuda, says, why should we kill him? He's our brother. Let's sell him. What sense did that make? Because when you really, the selling didn't make sense. What made sense? Send him away with Yishmael or with Midian. That made a great deal of sense to them. Why? Because that's a theme which goes throughout the book. As I say again, unfortunately. Reuven. Sefer HaYashar. The best explanation for this is in the, or the one that everybody quotes at least, is in the commentary of the Nitziv. He describes the decency. I mean, think about it. And in reality, the people in Bereishit didn't really have mitzvot. Don't get upset with me. They didn't really have mitzvot. And this is the idea. I said very few. They really didn't have mitzvot. The three mitzvot mentioned in Sefer Bereishit. They had Gid Hanasha. I don't know how moral that makes you. They prove you, if you will. Aver Min Hachai. Brit Mila. There are very, very few mitzvot. But what do we say? Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. Actually, the way that the Midrash says it, it says 26 generations before Matan Torah, we already had Derech Eretz. Which means Derech Eretz is what Sefer Bereishit is supposed to be about. But figuring out Derech Eretz sometimes is a little difficult as well. Go back to Reuven for a second. There's this incredible difficulty. Shimon and Levi say kill him. Reuven says, let's put him in the pit. And the Torah tells us what he has in mind. He's going to take him out and he's going to save him. Right? Yehuda then, afterwards, they sit down to eat. By the way, do you realize how bad that is to sit down and eat while your brother is screaming out of the pit? You know, ever go to a restaurant and the music is on a little too loud? That's nothing. Can you imagine a guy screaming from the pit, get me out of here? He's screaming. How do I know that they heard him? Later on in Egypt, when Yosef does the exact same thing to them, and what do they say? Because we ignored our brother's cry. By the way, is it interesting to you that on the way down to Egypt, again, think about it, you don't like your brother, so you sell your brother, you sell him as a slave. What ends up happening? They all become slaves. You can either call this karma or you can call it hashkacha. You think that you're selling your brother as a slave, you become slaves. Going down to Egypt, they sit down and they have a meal before they go down to Egypt. Is it now significant that they sit down and God tells us have a meal before we leave Egypt? No, the idea of having the meal before we leave Egypt is exactly what the Pesach Seder is going to be. You need to become whole as a family, which is why you invite all the relatives that you don't like. Sorry. No, she knows what I'm talking about. And that's why I can't say anything after this. Is that by the Pesach Seder we go in and the family becomes whole because the family has to. It says sit down as a family and eat before we can leave Egypt. That's the flip side of the coin of this meal that we had. Rashi then Reuven comes back and says, "Whoa, Yosef is gone. What happened to him?" And he tears his coat. Hold it. Where was Reuven during all this? So Rashi gives two interpretations. One interpretation is that it was his turn to go back to his father. Now then Rashi gives a second interpretation. The second interpretation is that he was davening. Now, stop for one second. My wife likes the second interpretation, and I'll tell you why in a second. The first interpretation, that he went back to his father, is a little preposterous. You all realize why? This is why Rashi needs to give the second interpretation. It's a far trip. If he goes back to his father, take his brother with him. Wasn't that the whole thing, to return him to his father? So he goes back to his father and say, I knew I forgot something. I left Yosef in the pit. So I'm saying it's not so simple to say that he left him in the pit and he went to his father and then he came back. It was his turn to take care of his father. The logistics of this are very challenging. What was the other interpretation that Rashi said? That he was davening. Now, my wife likes this interpretation because whenever there's things to be done in the house, then the men have to go daven, right? When the kids were young, you had to get them out in the morning. Sorry, got to go to shul, shacharis, and then in the evening, got to go to marav. And see, I know why Muslims pray five times a day, because they have more than one wife. What does it mean that he's davening right now? Like again, what kind of? It says he was davening, he was crying, he was upset because of what he had done in terms of going and or moving the bed or going onto the bed of Bilhah. What does it have to do with now? Because you know, if you think about it, brothers that want to kill brothers, we've seen that before. Cain kills Hevel. It doesn't work out all that well. He gets thrown. He wanders, gets thrown into exile. Eventually, he's murdered. Esav, who wants to kill Yaakov, what does he say? I'll wait for my father to be dead, and then I'm going to kill him. And here these brothers are saying, we're going to kill Yosef. They're not even going to wait. You're not even going to be a decent murderer like Esav. You're not even going to wait for your father to be dead. And Reuven is listening to this and saying, how in the world do they have such chutzpah? They don't even care about their father, about his feelings, about his sensibilities, and they're going to kill him. They're worse than Esav is. He goes, where do they get this from? And then he realizes where they got it from. They got it from him. He was the one who moved his father's bed, or he was the one who got in his mother's bed, as it were, or his stepmother's bed. And he realized then that his brothers got their attitude from him, which is why right then he breaks down and he cries, and he has to do tshuva right then. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that as well. He said right then he has to pray at that point, because he's devastated. You know, we're responsible not just for what we do, but we're also responsible what other people learn from what we do. And at that moment, when Reuven realizes what other people learned from him, that's why it becomes so absolutely devastating. But then the book ends on a happy note, because I don't want to completely depress you. It ends on a happy note. Because Yosef, who was the victim, and Yosef, who had the ability of taking revenge, chooses not to take revenge. I'm not going to say he gives the brothers the easiest time in the world. I'm just going to say two things about him, and then I'm going to finish. And then if you have questions, you have questions. If you don't, then you don't. Whatever. When he meets the brothers after all these years, you have to realize one thing. Yosef is brilliant, and he knows what the next step is going to be. He knows the brothers are going to come at some point. How does he know this? The second he heard Paro's dream. He knows that his dream is going to come true, and they're going to come back down. Why? Because, again, it goes back to the animals are going to get traded in now for the sheaves. He knows that. Why? Because he also knows Sefer Bereishit. He knows that that's the theme from the very beginning. He knows that's going to happen, and that's how it's going to end. Trading in, the shepherds are going to end up trading in and end up getting food. And that's how the book ends. Which means Yosef has had a long time now to think what he's going to say when his brothers come. He's had at least 7 years. Actually, he's had 9 years, not even counting all the years that he spent in prison or Potiphar's house, thinking, what's he going to say when he sees them? So what does he say when he sees them? He says, they come in, and he says, you're spies. And they say, we're not spies. And he says, you are spies. And he says, we're not spies. And we are spies, we're not spies. What in the world does he want them to say? I thought about this a lot. And here's my alternative ending to Sefer Bereishit. The alternative ending is, Yosef says to his brothers, you're spies. Now, Yosef has a fantasy, right? We all have fantasies. You know what his fantasy was? That his brothers realized they made a mistake. And his brothers realized that it's their brother. And his brothers realized this is the worst thing we ever possibly could have done. And his fantasy is when he says to his brothers, you're looking for something, that they're all going to say, a long time ago, we got into a fight. We fought with our brother, and things did not work out, and he ended up down in Egypt, and we want nothing more than to find him and bring him home. If the brothers would have said that, what would Yosef have said at that point?
I'm the brother.
I'm Yosef. But they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. They couldn't say, we're looking for Yosef. And that's what he wanted. He goes, you're looking for something. By the way, the words, it's black and white in the Chumash. They say, we're 12 sons of one man. The youngest with his father. And how does the pasuk end? Ve'echad einenu. And what does Yosef then say? Hu asher amarti lachem raglim atem. He's the one I'm talking about when I said you're spies. And they say, no, we just want food. Realize what Yosef does then? Yosef puts them all in prison, which in Egypt was called a bor. Remember, he says, they put me in the bor. And then what does he do? He takes 10 of them out, leaves one behind, and then he puts money in their bag when they leave. What's the message of putting money in their bag? Apparently, you want money more than you want your brother. That's why you sold him. Same story again. Okay, he puts money in their bag. Here's the money. Go back, leave your brother behind and go. And Yosef is ever hear anybody scream silently? Yosef is screaming at them, you idiots. But they can't say it. They just can't say it. They cannot say we made a mistake, and they cannot say we're looking for our brother. And then Yehuda gives the greatest speech ever. And he says that his father loves him, and he's elderly, and this is the son that he loves. And if you take the son that he loves away from him, he's going to die. And what does he say? He goes, "Ani Yosef, ha'od avicha." By the way, it makes no sense whatsoever. Because if Yaakov's not alive anymore, then why is he bothering? Why would Yehuda offer to put himself as a slave for Binyamin if Yaakov's no longer alive? Of course Yaakov's alive. Do you realize what he's saying? Yehuda just gave a speech and said, if you take away the son away from my father, my father's going to die because he loves his son so much. So what does he say? "Ani Yosef, ha'od avicha." I'm Yosef. Is my father still alive? Didn't you just say that if you take the son away from him that he loves, he's going to die? I'm Yosef. Is my father still alive? And in that moment, they can't speak. They can't speak. And right then, if Yosef then says, and as your punishment, we wouldn't be surprised. If right then Yosef puts them in prison or kill, whatever. And instead Yosef does the opposite, which is why the book ends with a happy message. Instead he does the opposite. He embraces them all. And he says, it wasn't you. He gives them a way out. He goes, it was God. You're just a pawn in God's plan. God told this to Avraham hundreds of years ago. It doesn't say that black and white. That's what he's saying to them. God said this to Avraham hundreds of years ago that we're going to end up Brit Ben Ebtarim, hundreds of years ago, you're a shliach. You're a shliach of Hashem. You're emissaries of God. And he gives them a way out. And Yosef then takes care of his brothers. He's 39 years old now. He's going to die at the age of 110. So for the next how many years? 39... to 110, so next 71 years, he's going to give his brothers homes, food, clothing, jobs, take care of them. That's how Yosef pays them back. Which means if the whole book is about brothers that can't get along, can't get together, can't be united, when the victim is able to turn around and say, but you're still my brothers, and I'm going to treat you as brothers, and it doesn't make a difference if you didn't treat me as brothers, that's why nonetheless the book ends on a happy note. Thank you.